Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, social critic, and mentor. Navigating the messy art of living and the complex beauty of relationships through these conversations that we need to have, but we often shy away from. It's another Tuesday, and it's time for a conversation with the reluctant therapist. Elizabeth, what are we doing today? Where are we going?
Today, we are going to start a conversation around Mental Health Awareness Month. The theme of the next few weeks will be kind of tapping into different ways that we address mental health and well-being. So that's the overarching place that we are going today. I'm not really sure how we're getting there, but I have a few different ideas because we'll back up. So in my classroom, one of my classes I would imagine is more anxiety provoking for my students than others because there's a lot of opportunities or expectations that the students are going to speak out loud in class and kind of share how they're feeling and show off their skills because they're learning the basic helping skills. And as we all know, the biggest fear that people have is speaking in public. People would rather die than speak in public, which, you know, is difficult for someone like myself who loves speaking in public and really, you know, kind of feels fired up. I like being in front of a room. I like, you know, sharing my knowledge. So that's never been my thing. I fear death. The fear one, the overarching fear. But I do understand that for people who have this anxiety or this phobia about speaking in front of others, it's crippling. And I'm aware of that. And I've been teaching this class in helping skills for 16 years. And at the beginning of the quarter, I can see the look on my students' face when I say, there's going to be a lot of interaction and we're going to go around the room and I'm going to be asking you to speak out loud. And I can see that terror and the quick, you know, calculations. Can I drop this class and still graduate from college, which they can't because it's a required class. So I have them captive. But universally, by the end of the quarter, students will write, this class gave me so much confidence. This class taught me I could do these things. I sat in that discomfort and I was able to navigate. And so I feel very confident in the way that I push the students to speak out and, to have to show off their skills and to get comfortable. And, you know, the end of the quarter, they actually do a simulation where they sit with another student and practice these skills that we're learning all quarter of listening and responding, these basic helping skills, and they do it in front of the entire class. And that's another thing on the first day of class when I say, and by the end of the quarter, you're going to use these skills and do it in front of everyone. They can't believe it happens. But they get there. And year after year, quarter after quarter, I see the students get there. And that growth that they have is so important. But I also recognize that the pathway from getting to that first day of class to the last day of simulations can be really, really challenging for a lot of students. So yesterday in class, one of the students came up after and said, I'm really struggling with kind of my mental health around this. I'm feeling really anxious and uncomfortable, and I know how to do the skills, but when I'm in class, all of a sudden I get so frozen and I can't move forward, and I just, you know, really feel like there's something wrong with me. And so it's a great opportunity to get to talk about and normalize these feelings of uncertainty and discomfort and those anxious feelings that come about when we do something that we're not sure of or something that we don't feel proficient in and how common it is. But the part of the statement that stuck out with me and kind of led me to today's topic was her assumption that because she was uncomfortable doing this thing that is understandably uncomfortable,
right,
that it somehow is indicative of a mental health issue. And that's a big shift. I think that says a lot about the current state of mental health care or the current state of how we address mental health, or maybe the population, the generation that's coming up, or the population today. The attitude about mental health is that anything that feels uncomfortable, anything that makes us feel uneasy is some sort of symptom or sign that our mental health is failing. And so I wanted to address on this, you know, beginning of or on the cusp of Mental Health Awareness Month, kind of what mental health and well-being looks like and all the ways that the most common of those mental health complaints, anxiety, shows up in our lives in ways that are normal. Because if we can normalize responses to uncomfortable situations, then it might not make it better. And again, in all honesty, I feel anxious every week before we open up the microphone. I feel anxious every day before I start class. I feel anxious every quarter before we start out and I meet the new students. You know, my stomach gets in a knot. I worry if I'm going to be good enough or if I'm going to have, you know, I'm going to be able to hold the students' attention. I worry about the mic opening up and me running out of things right to say for an hour. You know, I want to normalize all that as well, that as much as I enjoy the performance act, you know, activities of my life, they come with a great sense of anxiety and anticipation and, you know, concern. And to be fully transparent, when I leave the show at the end of the day, I cry a little bit in my car because there's such a release of that, you know, intensity of being here and being on the air and making sure I have myself organized. And the same when I leave school at the end of the day, there's kind of this huge letdown because I'm on for 7 hours while I teach. I've got to be at a certain level, and I get in the car and there's kind of this letdown and a little bit of crying, and then I'm ready to go again. And I think that's also important to share because the more we, again, can normalize those experiences, the less they take hold, the less that they're able to, like, find the spot inside of us, our weak underbelly, and just attack it. And then we start to churn on that part of us that we think is not great. And that's what causes and can lead to mental health concerns. Now, as always, I want to talk about the spectrum of mental health because mental health is many, many things. Mental wellness is many, many things. And on one end of the spectrum, we have psychosis, psychotic breaks, schizophrenia, major depressive disorder, which means you can't sleep or get out of bed or function. And then on the other far end of the spectrum, we have things like social anxiety, generalized anxiety, you know, just kind of the lower level feelings of uncertainty or insecurity or relational things. Doesn't minimize them that they're not painful. But if you're looking at the scale or the spectrum of mental health concerns, it's wide. And the vast majority of mental health issues falls on the side of situational or task of daily living, having to speak in front of people. That's a vast majority of the things that kind of throw us off. Grief, relationships, transitions, all those things we expect people to have some trouble with. Very few people are going to go through a grieving experience without feeling deep loss and sadness. Very few people are going to be able to get fired from a job, and there's a lot of people experiencing that today. Very few people can have that experience and wake up the next day and go, yeah, I'm fine. Things are good. We would expect you to feel angry, out of sorts, lost, concerned. Like, we expect those reactions, which is what makes mental health kind of a tricky, mental health care a tricky profession on one point, but also our understanding of our mental wellness difficult because if we're really uncomfortable and yet it's really common, how do I deal with those two things? Because when we talk about physical wellness, you know, if you have headaches for multiple days or your stomach's in pain or those physical symptoms, then our go-to is why we should go to a doctor and make sure there's not something going on with me. But on the other hand, with mental health, if I get butterflies every time, you know, I start doing a sporting event, or I feel grief when someone dies and that goes on for weeks and weeks. And if I feel anger or disappointment, if I get fired from a job or lose a job and it goes on for weeks and weeks, that doesn't necessarily mean that we'd need to go in for medical care or for mental health treatment. And so that makes it a little complex. It's like, yes, go in if your stomach is in pain for a period of time, but if you're grieving for weeks or months at a time, we expect that. And so it would be my dream that there was some sort of, okay, another caveat though, Brad.
Okay.
Given the state of what's happening in the Department of Education, I feel sad that it's not fair to be offering other suggestions for public education. So I do acknowledge that things are shifting. But if I got to rewrite our public education curriculum, I would have a whole section on preventative mental health care, starting from the time kids are in kindergarten and talking about death and loss and grief and what those experiences are and normalizing them and talking about social anxiety, not calling it social anxiety, but talking about how it's a little scary to go into new situations and it's normal to feel uncomfortable or awkward. I would normalize all of these things that we expect people to experience throughout their life so that we're not surprised by it when we have our first panicking experience, or we have our first awkward sense of loss, whatever it is. It amazes me that we haven't always taught these skills, because when people get into a mental health crisis, they always seem to be surprised. Like, how did this happen to me? How did I go from being so comfortable and relaxed in my own body, and now I feel anxious all the time and can never settle down? You know, how did this happen to me? Why, when my, you know, spouse passed away, did I go into this deep, deep depression? Why? It surprises me that people are surprised that they have mental health crises. And that's what makes the mental health profession such a challenge, because when people feel like what I'm experiencing, or say to themselves, what I'm experiencing is not normal, I need help, it sets them up for getting into situations that may give them a sense of relief, but also may be unnecessary. So that was a long roundabout way of saying today, I want to talk a little bit about Mental Health Awareness Month, but we're going to really focus on anxiety, which is the most common of all the mental health disorders, along with depression. And sometimes people struggle with anxiety mixed with depression as well. It can be complex. But instead of taking the deep dive into, you know, what we could consider clinical anxiety, those types of panic disorders, PTSD, phobias that really are resistant to just self-care. I want to focus on the parts of anxiety that show up in our lives on a regular basis and to normalize them in a way that we can anticipate, oh, I'm going to feel anxious in this, and use that anxiety to our, maybe to our benefit, or maybe not to be thrown off by it. So that's the goal. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. You'll be invited to be part of our conversation today. Our number is 805-781-3875. When you think about anxiety, how does it show up in your life? How do you experience it, manage it, or not manage it? 805-781-3875. You can also send me an email after the show to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can find me on Facebook and Instagram and leave me a message there. You can go to my website, thereluctanttherapist.com. You can also contact me there. And you can podcast our show by visiting Spotify or Apple Podcasts, wherever it is you get your podcasts. Hit subscribe and leave a review. It's also helpful because other people can find us. And you can also visit kcbx.org to look for previous shows, because we go much farther back on the website if you'd like to really take a deep dive.
You're everywhere.
I feel like it. Well, I think we're also on YouTube, thanks to Jackie. There's YouTube as A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. So yeah, everywhere. I'd love you to be a part of it. We're going to take a quick break, come back and jump into this conversation about anxiety right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Imagine me. I think about you day and night. It's only right to think about the girl you love and hold her tight. So happy together. If I should call you up, invest a dime, and you say you belong to me, and ease my mind. Imagine how the world could be so very fine. So happy together. Baby,
Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I love that song because it sets us up for one of the first parts of how anxiety shows up, and it's in relationships and in the attraction phase of relationships. But before we get there, I wanted to say one more thing about Mental Health Awareness Month, because we're going to tap into it for the next few weeks. But the idea of Mental Health Awareness Month is really to bring about awareness of the importance of understanding how our mental health works. And just as we talk about getting a yearly physical and improving our physical health when we're not feeling well, eating better, getting more sleep, you know, your mental health care is pretty much the same thing, and that it takes the same kind of attention. So there's these five C's to success when it comes to mental health care, and they include connection, coping, community, care, and compassion, the five C's. And if we pay attention to those parts of our life and we put time into them, then we can maybe not guarantee, but we know that we're doing the work to keep our mental wellness on a balanced level. One of the most key parts of this that's not in the five C's, but it's sleep. Getting enough sleep is really critical for our mental health, our nervous system to reset. Just like, you know, sometimes you have to turn off the computer and let it completely go off so it can reset. It's the same with our nervous system, that getting enough sleep, proper sleep, is when our body resets all of our responses. And so that's a good setup, especially with young kids, to help them get into healthy sleeping patterns is so important. And then nutrition as well. We talk a lot about that connection between gut and brain, and more research is coming out showing the importance of, you know, our nutrition in stabilizing our mental health. But then these others, connection, coping, community, care, and compassion, are kind of a nice reminder of how our days should be spent, especially when we're battling against, you know, social media, which gives the illusion of connection, but is not connecting at all. It's actually incredibly isolating. But connection means joining a club or having, you know, friendships that you count on, investing in your intimate relationships and having conversations. Because sitting on the couch next to each other, both looking at a screen, is not a connection with another person. You know, whenever our attention is divided, we're not connecting to the people right in front of us. And so there's an interesting statistic that if you want to have what they call a soul connection relationship, this deeply connected, intimate partnership, and that's a high bar, but it requires about 20 hours a week of connection with your partner. Most people, even though they're living together and sitting side by side on their couches or playing video games, spend less than 20 minutes a week in real intimate connection. That's conversation, cooking together, going for walks, you know, having sex, holding hands, you know, just spending that time in each other's presence with each other and not in each other's presence doing different things. So that's the connection piece. And you really can only sustain far fewer relationships than you think you can. You can't sustain 100 relationships and keep close tabs on them. It's really closer to 25 to 50. And if you're close to your family, that knocks out a lot of them. The coping one, the second C, coping, means we have to accept what is, which seems so harsh and hardcore. But, you know, if things go poorly, if people die, if we lose relationships, if, you know, we go through a period of bad health, if we break a leg, the acceptance of that, the coping with that, is the second key skill. So start really young with your children, helping them develop resilience. Don't pad them from disappointments so that they can learn coping skills. Number three is community. Participate in some way. You know, and that's where I said joining a club. But being part of a club, being part of a volunteer organization, getting involved in your neighborhood, showing up for community walks and hikes. When you are connected, go to theater where you're sitting with a lot of people and having a similar experience. Go to concerts, Live Oak, you know, be with people and connect. Those are all ways that we feel like we're part of something larger than ourselves, which helps ground our mental health. Care, that self-care piece, and it's not as much as you think. It's not every day. You don't have to spend, 7 hours a day. But if you have two intentional times a week where you sit in a mindful state, do some intentional grieving of things that you've lost and gratitude for things that you have, kind of reset yourself for taking a look at your life, that's good self-care, along with, your eating habits and sleeping and that. And then finally is compassion. And compassion is a great exercise because it's not just compassion for others, but it's compassion for yourself. And in all honesty, I struggle with that one too. So don't feel badly about yourself if you don't have compassion for yourself, because it's interesting how you can have compassion for other people. You can see the world through the lens of their experience and go, God, I can see how that's really tough for you or why you're struggling. And yet when we turn the mirror back on ourselves, it's easier to I could have done better. Nah, why did I say that? Nah, why did that happen? So finding that ability to have compassion more times than not is helpful. So that's the intro to the Mental Health Awareness Month goals. So let's pivot to how anxiety shows up in relationships, because I find this fascinating. Number one, when it comes to attraction, that the survival mechanisms in our brain is right next to the attraction mechanisms in our brain. And it, evolutionarily, back in the day when we were hunters and gatherers, that spidey sense of where danger lurks was really important. That high intensity of knowing if you're safe or unsafe, because things were quite precarious at all times, caused the hormones to be released to keep us on guard. We released the adrenaline so you could run if you were being chased, and so you have the dry mouth and sticky, fingers and heart pounding, just as a response to the dangers around us. But evolutionarily, over, centuries, when we're not in danger all the time, we're relatively safe most of the time, we still have that kind of triggered response to things that we're unsure of. We don't know if we're safe. It feels a little precarious. But then we also have that trigger right next to the survival in the brain, then we meet someone we're highly attracted to, and we have that that rush of this is exciting, and we start to have our mouth get dry and our heart races and our palms get sweaty, are sticky, and so they're the same bodily response. So the brain doesn't really know, it can't discern whether this is a moment of fear where I should run away or a moment of pleasure where I should run at what is happening. And so for a lot of people, they're tied into this strong feelings of attraction, and that anxiety that comes with it causes them to feel afraid. I don't like that. That feels uncomfortable. I don't like the intensity of the feelings that are released when I'm with this person or near this person. I don't like that feeling out of control. And so that's a kind of a common reason that people back away from relationships, because the intensity. But conversely, and this one, Brad, you'll have to help me and make sure that if you don't understand it, tell me. But conversely, evolutionarily, if you grew up in a home and you had a lot of negative interactions, maybe you had a parent that said you're less than or put you down or made you feel insecure, told you weren't a good person, if you had a really negative experience in your family of origin, and then you grow up and you find yourself in a situation where you're deeply attracted to someone, and so that it releases all those great feelings, right? The adrenaline and the cortisol and, the estrogen, all kinds comes through, and your heart is pounding. You're really excited. It's like, oh my gosh, I really dig this person. But then you're also getting this release at the same time of the feelings of being less than, that kind of triggers those old survival feelings that you had when you were a little kid. Like, this isn't a safe place. I don't really feel good here. I'm having my feelings hurt. But unfortunately, it's the same hormones that get released. So you have this double whammy of these hormones that actually cause you to feel extra attracted to someone who's really not healthy for you. People always wonder, like, why am I keep ending up with this bad boyfriend? Why am I in this relationship with this person? I can't get out of it. I'm just so attracted to them, but I know that they're not good for me. And it goes all the way back to this basic biological response that releases these hormones that can be really confusing. And the only, you know, not the only, but one of the ways to address it is where psychotherapy really does work well, that comes in very handy, of being able to go back and understand these early triggers to kind of heal whatever those childhood wounds were, or that sense of being less than, or to also be able to recognize and untie yourself from those things. Because you can't make people be attracted to different people. We're attracted to who we're attracted to. But what we can look at is the other driving force. If it's unhealthy relationships that I keep getting into and keep getting into, what's the part that's driving my attraction to these unhealthy relationships? And it's the part where these feelings that made us feel badly but triggered those same hormonal responses get caught up in the relationship. And so to address and look at those early childhood wounds can help us disconnect from that attraction to the bad boyfriends.
Is it part, though, that when you're a child and you're having these interactions mm-hmm. with your family of origin, mm-hmm. you know, you're wide open to them because they are your origin, right? Mm-hmm. So you have this feeling of complete vulnerability to them. Mm-hmm. So I guess, isn't it a matter of the fact that when we find ourselves in these relationships that are terrible for us, that we're feeling these feelings of wanting to be open and vulnerable, and perhaps we already have been to them, and now it's either the fear of you know, having the negative response that we got from our family, or it's the fact that we're actually getting it from them once we open up to these people continually making bad choices by being open with people who are not going to treat us well.
They're kind of two separate things. A little bit, because the first one, the one I was talking about, is more of an unconscious connection, because you can't consciously understand that why is this incredible attraction to this person? Mm-hmm. You know, my heart's racing. They must be the one for me. That is an unconscious response. You're not really recognizing the drive of the childhood. The other part is more in relationships that are. Might have intimate partner violence, you know, or you're conscious of the way that this relationship is not good for you, mm-hmm. and yet you still feel connected. It's the difference between the consciousness of this person treats me poorly, and in my childhood I was treated poorly. The research was for the one I was talking about is when people aren't really aware that how they were treated as children, right, was harmful to them,
right.
or that made them feel bad about themselves. They just normalized it. And so it's not until they get older. So they're similar, but they're two different drives in some way. So that's how anxiety shows up in kind of the attraction piece. The other way that anxiety shows up in relationships is in a common, very common dynamic called the pursuer-distancer relationship. And we might have talked about that before, but the pursuer-distancer relationship is one person really wants to address conflict, really wants to feel close to their partner, really wants to make sure that if there is some issue, they're addressing it right away. Let's make sure that we attack this. Let's make sure we don't let go to bed mad. And then the distancer is a person like, I like the way things are. Let's not blow it up. Why do we always have to talk about our relationship? You know, why can't we just be happy? Let's just, you know, go out to dinner and forget we had an issue. The thing that's happening in the pursuer-distancer relationship is anxiety-based, because when the pursuer starts to feel like their partner isn't really engaged or might be slipping away or isn't really addressing things, they feel anxious. Anxiety starts to creep up. And when we feel anxious, we want to try to tap down that anxiety feeling. We want to try to calm it. And so for the pursuer, going towards their partner and saying, do you love me? Do you love me? Let's talk about it. Let's make things better, is their attempt to calm the anxiety they feel. Conversely, though, for the distancer, when they feel someone coming towards them and wanting something, they start to feel anxious. Their anxiety comes up. And so in their attempt to calm their anxiety, they start to back away. I need some space. I need to calm down. I want to catch my breath. And so you can imagine then the conflict for these relationships, because both parties are trying to calm their anxiety and it's not working. And so it can cause this ongoing sense of discomfort and anxiety for both partners in the relationship. the pursuer, distancer relationship. And we see it, you know, in different places in friendships as well. And sometimes, you know, when people might have that in a parent-child relationship, you know, when the essence of how we're calming our sense of anxiety causes us to either chase someone or back away, that is our anxiety, that is our attempts to bring down our anxiety levels. So this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Time is going really fast today, I say, because I have all these things I want to talk about. And woo, it's time for us to catch our breath. We are going to take a quick break and come back. And we'll open the phone lines at 805-781-3875 if you'd like to chat about Mental Health Awareness Month or how you experience anxiety in your life. 805-781-3875. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Feeling like a drop in the ocean that don't nobody notice. Maybe it's all just in your head. Feeling like you're trapped in your own skin, and now your body's frozen. Broken down, you've got nothing left. When you're high on emotion and you're losing your focus, and you feel too exhausted to pray, it's okay not to be okay.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. Our number is 805-781-3875. Did you have a question from someone?
I did. We had somebody call in during the music, but they didn't want to hang on the phone okay. Here. Sandy in Arroyo Grande had a question about anxiety, and she wants to know, does it ever really go away?
Well, that's such a great question. Well, the trouble with wanting the anxiety to go away is that it's such an important part of our human experience. Just as I was talking about kind of those experiences of feeling excited when we meet someone new, very tied with feeling anxious too. Will this work out? Will this, you know, is this someone I should be with? How will I engage with them? You know, those good feelings of kind of attraction and unknowing are kind of mixed into those anxious feelings. Also, feeling a bit of anxiety is what kind of motivates us to get up and speak on the radio or take on a new job or, you know, start a conversation with someone. We have that sense of that heightened awareness of being alive. And the other part about anxiety that's always stood with me is that the first week I went to grad school, one of the professors said, everyone is neurotic. Every person has some sort of neurotic tendency. He said, if you could choose your neurotic tendency, I would choose anxiety, because anxious people are the most alive people on the planet. As uncomfortable as it is, people who experience anxiety have no filters to the world, so they take everything in. That can be overwhelming to not be able to, you know, filter out the things that feel uncomfortable, but they feel the good things with such intensity that it's an amazing way to be present in the world. And that's always stuck with me. So you might be able to calm anxiety. You might be able to medicate it down to a sense of neutral. But we really don't ever want it to fully go away, because there is a reason that those anxiety and anxious feelings exist. They're important. I think more importantly than expecting the anxiety ever fully goes away is, how do I find the coping skills so that when anxiety is overwhelming, I can ride the wave? And how do I reset myself so that anxiety can be more of a companion than a foe? I hope that helps. 805-781-3875 is our number. And Richard, thanks for giving us a call. What's on your mind?
Yeah, you kind of brought my question up in the very end, but it was, what are some tools that you could suggest on coping or dealing with the involvement of that kind of relationship where you have a pursuer and a
distancer? Yes. Oh, I'm so glad you followed up with that, because I got off track with the other question. Okay. So there's a couple interesting things about the pursuer-distancer relationship. One is, you know, the anxiety piece. So if you can be aware that you have this pattern in your relationship, the best way to address it is to be able to name it, to be able to say, you know, I notice that when I'm feeling anxious about our relationship, I want to overwhelm you with me. You know, I just want to engulf you with me to make sure that I'm safe. And if my partner then can say, I recognize that, but I also notice that when you do that, I start to feel anxious, a little claustrophobic. And although I love you so much, I feel like I need space to breathe. So first, Richard, it's identifying, you know, noticing that that pattern exists. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally.
Okay. And then the second piece then is to have kind of make a deal with your partner. So to be able to say, you know, the pursuer might say, I'm feeling this need to kind of chase you right now. Or I'm feeling insecure. I'm feeling anxious about our relationship. And I need reassurance. And if the distancer then is able to say, I can reassure you that we're fine, but I need 15 minutes or I need 20 minutes. To be able to take that extra step to say, I can reassure you that we're fine or we are okay or I love you. I do need to take some time. And then for the pursuer to be able to say, I appreciate being affirmed and you can take that time and, you know, we'll reconnect. It feels very maybe robotic in some way, but it's the best way to really kind of cut through the emotions to get stable again.
Okay, sounds good.
Does that help? Any other follow-up question?
Well, I guess I was seeing more of the nature of a distancer versus having to fulfill that need of not being loved. And it's more like conflict management. It's really easy for certain people to distance themselves.
Yes.
And so my concern was, what is a good tool or method to not create anxiety for that person?
Wow. If you get that answer, though, then no one needs marriage therapy, Richard. And that would...
Right. Okay. But either way, I'm really happy that you have this show. And thank you for the suggestions.
I appreciate it. And I will continue on with that topic, too. Thank you for taking the time to call. So Richard brought up a good point, because the other part of the question is, where do we see anxiety in relationships? And it's in conflict management. So the pursuer distancer is kind of about the insecurity of love. And, you know, is it the distancer's responsibility to continually affirm the pursuer that they are loved? Probably not. Ideally, the pursuer would, you know, find their own compassion and self-worth and feel great about themselves. And wouldn't that be the ideal for all of us, that we feel so secure that we don't count on that or need that from anyone? That would be a goal. We probably can develop it more and more as we grow up. But it's such a common dynamic that being aware of it's probably going to be more effective than expecting that the pursuer is going to develop this sense of security and never need that affirmation. That I try to be a realist about these things, because in the world of psychotherapy, yes, we want people to individuate and to feel compassion for themselves, have self-love and do self-care and know their value and worth. That is our goals. And people on many levels are successful with that. But it's also just as common, if not more, for people to struggle with self-loathing and for self-criticism and for negative self-talk. And if you're spending any time on social media, you're just setting yourself up to have all of those negative experiences. Like, unfortunately, the way our society is set up, you know, the media message is constantly about you're not tall enough, thin enough, you know, well enough, smart enough. It takes a really intensely strong person to not ever have insecurities about anything.
I have a question, though, about this dynamic that we've been discussing. Mm-hmm. Is it possible that at some point in this pursuer distance or relationship that the roles can reverse?
Yes.
And maybe reverse back? I mean, you know, kind of
yes.
Go back and forth?
Yeah, great question. It has to do with the power of least interest, which is a power dynamic in couples, that the person that is least interested or least vested in the relationship tends to also be the distancer person, because they don't need the relationship. You know, sometimes it's around money. The person who brings in the most money is financially secure and they don't feel tied to the relationship, or maybe they're not as emotionally attached. So we can see that power dynamic. But here's the interesting thing about the pursuer-distancer dynamic in couples is that what happens quite often is the pursuer will say, let's go to counseling, or let's go on a date night, or let's get closer, or there's this distance. We need to work on it. Let's get, you know, let's make this happen. Do your part. Talk to me. They're really making the efforts, and the distancer's response is, I need some time, or why can't we just be happy the way things are? Why always nagging me? You know, why does it always have to be a problem? So that dynamic, and I know some of you are hearing your conversations as I say that, but what happens at some point, the pursuer stops. The pursuer stops pursuing because it's not going anywhere. They get frustrated. They get angry. They get disappointed. They start to withdraw themselves and look for that affirmation elsewhere. Could be in another relationship. Could be in some other hobby or, you know, some other activities. But the pursuer drops the chase and can oftentimes become indifferent. It's like, I can't keep throwing myself after this relationship. And then they might get to the point where they say, you know what, I'm done completely, and they serve divorce papers to the distancer. And that's when a distancer will say, what? What? What are you talking about? We were doing so good. You weren't complaining anymore. You weren't nagging me. It's like, yeah, because I gave up. I stopped, and I went out of this relationship. And then distancers all of a sudden, right, that power of least investment changes, and the distancer's like, I'll do whatever. I'll go to therapy. Tell me what to do. I'll make it better. Let's do a date night. And that's a really tough relationship to rescue, because if the pursuer has grown to a level of indifference or has started a new relationship, it's hard to bring them back. But at the heart of this, keeping with the theme of today, was the anxiety both partners were feeling, right? The anxiety of living in their own body or their own insecurities. And so, as I said to Richard, the healthiest thing we can do in relationships, in some ways even more than the whole self-love, self-care, positive self-talk, is to have what we call meta-communication exchanges with our partner. Here's something I recognize about myself. I tend to need more affirmation that you love me. I feel insecure, probably from growing up and wondering, you know, or not feeling like I was fully loved or supported by my family. But for whatever reason, I feel myself kind of chasing you for that. And to have my partner be able to say, huh, that's interesting, because I feel you chasing me. And it makes me pull away, probably because in my childhood experience, you know, there was that disconnect. My parents weren't really tight, whatever it is. The more you can meta-communicate about what you're experiencing and which drives your behaviors, the more you can heal that. Because it's when we just act on behaviors without any explanation of what's driving them is what gets us in trouble. And one last thing about the anxiety in relationships is about anxiety in conflict. And I think Richard brought that up as well, that all of us have a conflict management style, whether we know it or not. Some people, you know, want to address it. They want to look for compromise. Some people want to just ignore it and make it go away. Some people want to make sure that it's like a combat where there's a winner and a loser. They're always looking for some sort of, you know, resolution where I feel like I came away a winner. So all of us have different styles of addressing conflict. And there's some people who want zero conflict. And zero conflict is not a healthy way to go about things, because you end up just bottling up all of those bad feelings, and then you grow distance from each other, because you can't be in a relationship from someone when you're veiling or hiding half of how you truly feel. It might go along for years and years, but you're not really fully invested. And so it's the same with conflict, our anxiety about losing the relationship or feeling uncomfortable or bringing up bad feelings or hurting someone's feelings. That anxiety causes us to either shut down in conflict or to over, you know, pursue in conflict. Let's stay up until we get this worked out. So again, anxiety is at the foundation of our responses to many parts of our relationship. And if you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and our number is 805-781-3875. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. And let's shift then to anxiety and its role in growth and how we as individuals grow and expand and develop. Because our entire life, if we trust the process of growth and development, our entire life is a series of coming together and falling apart, and coming together and falling apart. And through all of these coming togethers and falling apart, ideally, we get stronger with each iteration of ourself. And that's why we have developmental theories and Erikson's stages of developmental growth. With each different stage we go through in our life, there are tasks and challenges that are associated with it. And if we are able to master those tasks and challenges, we are able to move on to the next stage. But with each stage, there is a period of dissonance, this feeling of mental discomfort or a tension that we experience because we're holding two conflicting beliefs or values. One is, I just want to stay the way things are. I don't want anything to change. And this other part of us that's saying, things need to be different. I need things to change. And that creates a sense of anxiety inside of us. And that anxiety ultimately is what motivates us as individuals to take action to reduce that sense of anxiety, to calm the anxiety, right? To reduce the dissonance. And so it forces us to move toward that new reality. And so in a healthy period of dissonance and growth, that anxiety forces us to move towards the next healthy stage, whether that's moving into adulthood or moving to a new relationship or, you know, taking on a new challenge. In the ideal dissonance and growth model, we accept that the change is happening and we reduce the anxiety by taking the steps to move to the next stage. In an unhealthy dissonance and growth experience, we try to deny the ultimate growth, right? We try to deny that need to move, and we try to calm our anxiety by staying rooted where we are, by trying not to change anything, by trying to clamp down. And unfortunately, by trying to clamp down and not, you know, experience the dissonance or the discomfort, we bury that anxiety and it comes up in different ways. We start to have panic attacks. We start to have higher experiences of anxiety. And so it's not really, it goes against what our inherent instinct is. If I feel anxious, I want to try to close down and keep myself safe. But when it comes to growing and developing throughout our lives and taking on new challenges, it's actually feeling that anxiety and moving towards it, going towards the thing that we kind of are fearing and the unknown and the uncertainty, moving towards that actually will have the greater sense of relief and reducing anxiety than trying to just clamp it down. So dissonance and growth, every single developmental theorist from Jung to Erikson to Levinson, and I don't expect you to know all the names, Dabrowski, all these amazing developmental psychologists have the same outcome, that growth is about leaving one known state and traversing either, some call it a bridge, some call it a slog through the mud, some call it, you know, a floating down the river, whatever it is, it's a moving one solid from one solid place and traveling to the next. And it's in that period of time that we feel the most anxiety, we feel the most uncertainty, we feel the most concern. And if we can take that feeling and say, oh, wow, this uncertainty and anxiety, I'm feeling this restlessness, this inability to kind of sleep or sit still, those are signs that I'm growing. I'm going someplace that's going to make me a more whole and experienced and lively human being. See, everything's a story. And how you interpret the anxiety has everything to do with the story you're telling about it. Our number is 805-781-3875. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And Sean, thanks for taking the time to call. You're on the air.
Hey, I think that you're going to find this interesting. I had a nervous breakdown right before the election, about a month before the election, because I'm an activist, and realized that things were not going well and that it was kind of impossible to communicate the level of threat that we were facing to people. And so I had a nervous breakdown and just completely locked down. I have post-traumatic stress disorder from childhood and anxiety disorder. So these are the natural things that happen to me as I just stop. And it was frustrating because I couldn't do what I normally do. But I went to therapy, and what was interesting is in digging into it, it was like, you know, what is your issue? A little fear, a little anxiety. Yeah, sure. She said, what else do you feel? You know, a little, I'm mad, you know, I'm mad about stuff. Okay, I've got rage. I've got real rage. And I discovered that most of it was just this incredible rage that I had no idea was even there, you know? So that was really interesting, and had to work on that. And what I wanted to share with other people that may have, I've for 5.5 decades, I've had a sleeping disorder where I wake up in the middle of the night, I cannot go back to sleep for hours. We tried a number of different anti-anxiety pills, and I started taking hydroxyzine, I think it's called. And it's just been a miracle for me. I mean, for some reason, I don't know why, I asked myself, why is this working? And what it seems to do is it keeps my brain waves flat when I get up at night to go to the bathroom. It's usually when I think, you know, oh, there's A, B, C I've got to think about. That doesn't happen when I take this 12.5 milligrams of pill, you know?
What a relief, right?
It is. It's incredible. I sleep through the night for the first time ever. It's awesome.
And it's amazing how sleep, as I said at the beginning of the show, is so fundamental to resetting our nervous system.
It is, yeah, completely important.
Because you can't get up and be the activist you want to be if you're just shredded every single day.
Yeah, exactly. And it doesn't work with the PTSD at all.
No. So how are you doing these days, Sean? What are you up to?
Well, my mother had a stroke, so I moved into her place, and I'm caring for her. But other than that, everything is, you know, this is normal day-to-day stress, I guess. I don't know. To be honest with you, after the election, a lot of my stress went completely away because at that point I couldn't do anything about it anymore. You know, there are activist challenges certainly now, but since my mother had a stroke, that's kind of...
The priorities change.
Oh, completely. It's so weird because I went to Mexico, and on the way to Mexico, I was thinking, you know, about all these activist things. I was all very serious and a little, you know, anxious and stressed about that. And on the way back from Mexico, after I got the emergency call that my mother had a stroke, suddenly all that went away. I can't even remember what I was going to do when I got back. Care for my mother. That's what I'm going to do. You know, the hell with politics. So.
You were able to put all of those feelings, right, that intensity, into something productive that you actually could control, which was being able to help your mom.
Boy, that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
I mean, that's the essence of anxiety, is feeling like we're out of control of all things. So you know, when you have the strength and the maturity to say, I'm going to go take care of my mom. And then that also settled you in this space of, you have a mission right now. That's incredibly important.
You bet. And it's a mission with a, you know, a tangible outcome.
Yes. I understand. I totally understand that. I appreciate your honesty and wanting to share that too, and that you found relief, because we can't get better until we can at least feel like we've got some sort of path forward. And this gave you a path forward.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Yeah.
Thank you for taking the time to call. I appreciate you, Sean.
Sure. Have a great day.
You too. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And today we've been talking about Mental Health Awareness Month. And, you know, I wanted to stress that when we talk about mental health, you know, it's a spectrum. We find ourselves in different places at it at different times in our life. And over 50% of all adults will have some sort of mental health crisis in their lifetime. That's just statistically true. And so to, one, be aware that there are mental health reactions to traumas that we go through in our life, but there's also ways that we can learn to cope and move forward and to find new ways of addressing what's going on in the world. And I think most importantly, to recognize that we may not be able to control all things around us, but we can control how we respond. And that really is at the essence of our mental health, is being able to recognize that I'm going to have responses to things that make me sad or make me angry and rageful or make me disappointed. We have plenty of things to be upset and disappointed about. There's never a lack of it. But that you get to choose every day how you respond to whatever's going on in the world. And that helps then to move us from one state of knowing the world to getting to that next state. And everything in between, it can be over the course of an evening that we have that reset, but it can also take weeks or months. And for some people, it can be years of traveling this really challenging, unknown path before we kind of find our way coming back together. Then to also appreciate when we come back together and we're feeling this state of wellness, because the more we can appreciate that state of wellness and really take it in, when that state of wellness starts to change again and growth is calling us, at least we can take with us this understanding, oh, I know how to I'll find my way back to this place. I need to go on this journey wherever it's going to take me, but I know that I can experience this place and I will come back to it. So this has been a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And again, you can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com or find me on Instagram and Facebook and leave me a message there. You can podcast our show to share with friends wherever it is you get podcasts. We're on Spotify. If you leave a review there, it helps more people find out about the show. You can listen to previous shows also at kcbx.org. But as always, I appreciate you taking the time to tune in and spend your Tuesday afternoons with me right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. When you're moving right up close to me, that's when I get the shakes all over me. Quivers down the back. Shaking all over. Down the backbone, I get the shakes in the knee bone, tremors in the thigh bone, shaking all over. Shaking all over. Shake.